Awesome. Well, welcome to Hoboken Grace. If this is your first time with us, I just want to echo what Chris said, and hopefully you've just made yourself right at home. My name is Chris High, and I'm the teaching pastor here at Hoboken Grace. And usually here, we're in the midst of some kind of conversation, and Chris said that we're in the midst of one right now. I don't know who told him that. We concluded one last week and we're beginning one next week. But we love these in-between weeks because it gives us a chance to talk about what God's doing inside of our family. And it gives us a chance to be able to talk about and look at where we're going as a family. And so this morning, I'm super excited because we are actually right on the brink of what will probably be the greatest transition so far in the history of our church. I mean, history is kind of a weird word. We've been here for 5 years, so whatever that means, right? But as long as we've been around, this is probably the greatest transition that we will have walked through. And if you don't know, right now, we are one church, one location, three services here. As we move through the next few months, we're going to be moving to three different locations, one church, but three different locations, all sorts of different service times, stretching from northern Hoboken, 800 Clinton Street, all the way into Hamilton Park. It's a huge transition. And transitions are crucial. Whether you're an individual, whether you're a family, it doesn't matter. Whether you're an organization, transitions are absolutely crucial. Because transitions present you with an incredible opportunity for good or an incredible opportunity for bad. So, for example, just over the last couple months, it's come to my attention that I needed to transition my jeans, like the jeans that I wear, what the fashion of my jeans, and my staff brought this to my attention. Okay? And they basically nicely, and sometimes not so nicely, said to me, you need to buy different jeans because you look like an idiot on stage. And so I thought, well, okay, cool. I'll just go out and get some new jeans. And I didn't understand what they later pointed out to me, that there was a tremendous potential for bad. And they let me know that I had erred towards the bad side. And so that's what I mean. There's just this tremendous amount of potential. And some of you are like, oh, he's so petty. Don't lie to yourself. You've went through the same thing, okay? And some of you wives here are thinking, yeah, my husband needs to go through that same transition. All right. But transitions offer a tremendous amount of potential for good or for bad. And today, what I want to do is I want to walk through a passage that's found in 2 Kings that I think speaks to the transition that we're about to walk through, speaks to transition in all of our lives, and then at the end of it, presents us with this truth that I want to make sure is driving the conversation as we walk through this transition together. I want to make sure that as we move from this one location to multiple locations and everything that's going to come with this transition, that what we're talking about today is at the core of who we are. It's driving everything that we do, driving all of the conversations that we have. And we're at this unique point as well as a church because we've walked through 5 years now together. And not all of us have been here the whole time, but together we've walked through this 5-year point. And so we're also at this transition from that first 5 years and looking into the next 5 years. And so I want to make sure as we're in the midst of all of these transitions that what we're about to talk about today is at the core of who we are, what we're doing, how we look at what God has called us to do, and how we operate in the midst of it. And so as we begin today, we're going to be going to a passage. It's found in 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 1 through 15. But before we go into that passage, I need to give you a little bit of a background, okay? This is about a transition. As a matter of fact, the story we're going to read is a transition. It's a transition from one prophet in the nation of Israel to another prophet. And the names are really confusing. And I'm just going to tell you as we begin today that I'm going to mess them up, okay? Because the one prophet is named Elijah and the other prophet is named Elisha, okay? And this story is about the transition from Elijah being the main prophet in the nation of Israel to Elisha becoming the main prophet in the nation of Israel. I love this passage. It's unbelievably meaningful to me, and I'll explain that to you as we walk through today. But as you look at this story and this transition, there's a couple things that you need to know before we get there. Number one, you need to understand how these two individuals came together in the first place. You see, Elijah was the most powerful prophet in the history of the nation of Israel. Unbelievably powerful. The miracles that he had done and what he had been able to accomplish was unparalleled. I mean, this guy is raising people from the dead. He's calling down fire from heaven. His story is incredible. And as you look at his story, you see him doing all these amazing things over and over and over and over again. But as is the case with almost every single one of us, even when you're following God, when you're experiencing God, there's this tremendous temptation to take your eyes off of who God is and to begin to focus at whatever you're up against. And Elijah was up against a lot because he existed at a time period in the nation of Israel where everyone was beginning to abandon God and beginning to worship this God named Baal. And so the powers and the forces that ruled the nation of Israel were doing everything that they could to kill Elijah. And in the midst of this, his life looks like a war as you read through his story. He's doing unbelievably powerful things, but at the same time, people are constantly trying to kill him. And people are constantly trying to wipe him out. And so he's escaping and running. And as he's doing this, he comes to this point where he takes his eyes off of God. He takes his eyes off of what God's doing and how God's moving and how God's working. And he begins to focus on what he's up against. And he begins to look at those who are trying to kill him. And he falls into what looks like, when you read the story, just a real depression, like a deep depression. And he's terrified. And he's running for his life and hiding in caves. And just scared to death. And in the midst of that, he has a conversation with God. And God comes, and it's a beautiful way in which God cares for him as you read the story. But God comes to him and says, "Listen, Elijah, what's going on?" And Elijah says, "Look, all these people are trying to kill me. I'm the only person who's following you. I'm all alone." And God helps him recover from that. And in the midst of him helping him recover from that, one of the things that he does is he says, "Listen, I want you to know you're not alone. There are others who are following me. And not only do I want you to know that, I want you to experience that." And so he sends him to Elisha. And he brings Elisha on as his apprentice. And he's teaching him and training him how to be a prophet of God. But more importantly, and this is the thing that you really need to understand about the backstory here. Elisha's job was to make sure that Elijah was never alone. And his primary function, the thing that he was supposed to do more than anything else, was to make sure that at no time was Elijah ever alone. So that he would never fall back into this idea that I'm the only one, there's no one else. And so God says to Elisha, "Your job is to make sure that this man's never alone." And so you need to understand that as we go into the story. You'll understand why in just a second. We're going to pick up the story in 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 1 through 5. It says, "When the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were traveling from Gilgal." So they've been walking together for quite some time. Elisha has learned a ton from Elijah, and they're coming to the point where finally they're going to make the transition. God's actually informed Elijah that he's going to die, that he's going to take him up into heaven. He actually doesn't die, but he informs him, "Your time is over." I don't know how much information he had about how it was going to look or how it was going to work, but he informs him, "Your time is over. It's time for you to transition to Elisha being that prophet." And so everyone knows that this is coming. Everyone knows that this is about to happen. And they're on their way there to be able to begin this transition. It says, "And Elijah said to Elisha, 'Stay here, for the Lord has told me to go to Bethel.' But Elisha replied, 'As surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I will never leave you.' So they went down together to Bethel." Now, if you don't understand the background of this story, that's not going to be as meaningful as it is when you do, right? And so as they're getting ready to walk into this transition, Elijah knows that his time's over. He knows that he's supposed to go to this location. And so he starts heading there and he turns to Elisha and says, "Listen, I want you to just stay here. You just stay behind." And Elisha says, "As long as you're alive and I'm alive, I'm never leaving you. I'm going to do what God asked me to do." The group of prophets from Bethel came to Elisha and asked him, "Don't you know that the Lord is going to take your master away from you today?" "Of course I know," Elisha answered, "but be quiet about it." All these other people are coming up and talking to him because there's all this potential here now, right? Like, okay, you're going to be the next guy. Are you ready? What are you doing? And Elisha says, "Listen, that's, don't talk about that. I got to do what I'm supposed to do." And so he stays with Elijah. It says, "Then Elijah said to Elisha, 'Stay here, for the Lord has told me to go to Jericho.' But Elisha replied again, 'As surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I will never leave you.' And so they went on together to Jericho." It happens again. Then the group of prophets from Jericho came to Elisha and asked him, "Did you know that the Lord is going to take your master away from you today?" "Of course I know," Elisha answered, "but be quiet about it." Then Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, for the Lord has told me to go to the Jordan River." But again, Elisha replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I will never leave you." So they went on together. 50 men from the group of prophets also went and watched from a distance as Elijah and Elisha stopped beside the Jordan River. Then Elijah folded his cloak together and struck the water with it. The river divided, and the two of them went across on dry ground. Like I said, this guy is unbelievably powerful. And as we get to this point in the story, I want to stop for a second because I think that there are two things that we've already seen in this story that are absolutely crucial when it comes to transition. And from the beginning of this story, everyone involved knew that there was going to be a transition. Everyone involved knew that Elijah was going to be taken away in some way, shape, or form, and that Elisha was going to be the one who was going to step into that position. And so everywhere that they went, people were coming up to Elisha saying, "Are you ready? Have you gotten ready? What are you doing? Do you know what's about to happen?" And Elisha, over and over again, continued to tell them, "Listen, stop. Leave me alone. I got to do what I'm supposed to do." And here's what I want you to know. If you have your notes card with you, if you would, just pull that out because I want you to jot these things down. They're absolutely crucial. And every single one of us encounters transition. And I want to make sure, not only that we know how we're going to walk through this together as a church, but that individually, we know how to be able to walk through transition in order to be able to experience the potential for good instead of experiencing the potential for bad. And so the first thing that you need to understand when you're going through transition, whether you're taking a new job, whether you're moving to a new city, whether you're adding someone to your family, whether you're getting married, whatever it may be, we walk through transitions all the time. The first thing that you absolutely have to do when you're walking through transition is this. You need to make sure that you do what you know to do. And that you focus on what you know to do. I want you to just for a second put yourself in Elisha's shoes. He knows that this one who's led him, this one who's really led the entire nation of Israel, is about to be taken away from him. He's about to step into this position. Can you imagine all of the things running through his head? The questions must have been phenomenal. What is this going to look like? How is this going to work? God, what do you want me to do? There are so many new questions being introduced into his experience. And in the midst of that, and not only is it coming from within him, it's also coming from outside of him, right? These other prophets are coming saying, "Do you know what's going to happen? All these new questions are being introduced. In the midst of that, he does something unbelievably powerful. He focuses on what he knows he's supposed to do. And I know it sounds really simple, but when you're in the midst of transition, it becomes unbelievably difficult. I'll give you an example. Some of you moved to Hoboken years ago. And you had a relationship with God, you were pursuing God, you were experiencing God, and then you got this job in the city, you moved to Hoboken, and you knew, man, I need to find a group of believers that I can connect with and begin to grow with. I need to find a local church body that I can be part of and begin serving with. You knew that was what you needed to do. But when you go through transition, there's all sorts of new things that enter into the equation. Things that you need to accomplish, new questions that you need to answer, things that you want to explore. And in the midst of that, you will lose sight of what you know you're supposed to do. And some of you, that's exactly what happened in your life. You lost sight of what you knew to do. And you thought it was good. You thought it was fine. But you let those things slide. And because of that, 3 years later, you ended up somewhere you never, ever thought you would be. Another example, you step into this new job and you know that you need to protect that time with your wife. You know that you need to make that a priority. But you step into this new job and there's all these new things that need to be accomplished and I need to do this and go here and go there. And in the midst of that transition, it's not that you don't value it, you just stop focusing on it. And 3 years later, you find yourself in a relationship you never, ever wanted. How did this happen? Oftentimes, you can trace it back to a transition where you didn't pay attention to what you knew you were supposed to do. And you allowed all of the other questions, all of the uncertainty to take you away from the fundamentals. And you have to make sure in the midst of transition that you focus on those fundamentals. And so in Elijah's life, he's going through this unbelievable transition. And I think one of the reasons why he experienced all of the good that's possible in transition is because he focused on what he knew to do. And he didn't let the uncertainty distract him. And I don't care what transition you're going through. You need to make sure that you remind yourself of this. Some of you are in the midst of transition right now, or you're about to walk through transition. Here's what I want to challenge you to do. Sit down and write out the things that you know you need to do. You're moving to a new town. You know, I've got to, within this amount of time, I've got to find a new group of people to get connected with. You're moving into a new job. You know, I've got to schedule my time where I make sure that I have time that's set aside for God. Oftentimes in the transition into a marriage, this can happen. And so you step into this marriage and there's all these uncertainties and all these things that you're trying to figure out as a couple and you lose your focus. You go into it and you know going into it that your ability to be able to love this other person is based upon your experience of God, based upon the time that you're spending with God, the way that He's loving you so that you can love them. Right? You know it, but you get into it and there's all these things of what, and in the midst of transition, you lose sight of what you know to do. And it ends up derailing you. If you're in one of those positions, I want you to look at taking time to be able to actually sit down and say, okay, what do I know to do that I want to keep in front of me throughout this entire transition period? On an individual basis. Now, here's the thing for us as a church. As we walk through this, especially for those of you who are in ministry, or for those of you who are going to begin to get plugged into ministry along the way, as we expand, as we grow, as we add services and ministries and all the different things that we're trying to do, both as a church and on Sundays and then also throughout the week, all these different things. As you walk through these transitions, what can happen is that we will lose sight of the fact that it's our relationship with God that allows us to be able to impact those around us, and we'll stop doing what we know to do in order to be able to accomplish what we think we should do. And in the process, we will lose who God has called us to be. Don't lose sight of what you know to do. I was talking with one of the guys afterwards, after the first service, and he said, you know, it's Super Bowl Sunday, so everything should be in the context of football. Although I have to tell you, I could not care less about tonight. It's weird for me. I don't know why. Like, once Baltimore entered the equation, I was like, I don't even know if I want to watch. I'm so angry about the situation. Sorry for those of you who are Baltimore fans, but I just don't like that team. But afterwards, we're talking about this, and he said, it's like a wide receiver. He says, sometimes in the midst of transition, we go to catch the ball, but rather than focusing on what we know we need to do, we start looking at what's next. We start looking at what else we have to do. And the second that we take our eyes off the ball before we've caught it, we drop it. You're in the midst of transition. focus on what you know you need to do and allow that to spread out into those things that are uncertain and those things that you think you need to do. The second thing that you need to know as you walk through transition, especially if you're going to experience the full potential of it, is this. You need to expect that those around you that you expect to encourage you, you need to expect for some of them to discourage you. And we don't know exactly what's happening inside this story. We don't know if God's using Elijah to test Elisha. We don't know if we have no idea why he continues to say this, but Elijah continues to turn to Elisha, and Elisha is trying to be faithful to what God has asked him to do, and it seems like Elijah's discouraging him from doing it. But wait a second, isn't this his mentor? Isn't this the guy who's supposed to be building into him? Isn't this the guy who's supposed to teach him to follow God? And again, we don't know why. I'm not saying that he's doing this to try to get him to walk away from God or to try to lead him into disobeying God. We don't know what he's doing here or why he asked the questions. But I do know this from personal experience. Oftentimes in the midst of transition, you will try to do something that's good. You will try to do something that's right. And the people that you expect to encourage you will discourage you. And you need to be ready for it. Because I almost guarantee you that there will be at least one person you expect to encourage you who will discourage you. And so you move to Hoboken with this friend who also has this relationship with God. And so you're here and you talk to them and say, you know, we need to get plugged into a local church. We need to find a church body where we can begin to serve and we can be part of the mission. And you expect for them to encourage you in it. But they don't. They discourage you. I experience this oftentimes with children and parents. We've got a very young church here. And so I'll see individuals who are deciding that they're going to actually become a servant, that they're going to actually serve God, to give their life to God, that they're going to begin making sacrifices for Him. And they expect for their parents, who have told them their whole life that they want them to follow God, they expect for their parents to encourage them, but as they share it with them, instead, they experience discouragement. You're like, wait, I didn't expect it from there. You need to look out for it. Because oftentimes in the midst of transition, especially if you're trying to experience the full goodness that it can bring, those that you expect to encourage you will actually discourage you. But don't allow that to derail you. And as a church, as we go through this, and as we're looking to move into these new spaces, and as we're looking to expand, and not just with our services, but also with what we're trying to do with our missions trips around the world, with what we're trying to do inside of our city, as we move into this, sometimes those that we expect to encourage us are actually going to discourage us. And for those of you who are here and you're like, man, I want to be part of this, and you're going to step into ministry, I want to let you know that as you do that, especially with spiritual growth, when you make the decision, man, I'm going to do this. I'm going to begin, for example, I'm going to begin to tithe, and I'm going to begin to give this way. And you expect that when you share that with your friend, that they're going to encourage you. But they hear that as an indictment on them. And so as opposed to hearing encouragement, you hear discouragement. Expect it. Look for it. And don't allow it to derail you. It will keep you from the full potential of good in the midst of that transition. And as we read through the story, the truth is this story is just packed with unbelievably good things. I mean, you look at the relationship between Elijah and Elisha and how he hands this thing off. It's really, really beautiful in a lot of ways. And then you look at this and you see how we can learn about how to walk through transition ourselves. But beyond that, I think there's something even bigger that we can learn from this story. And so I want us to continue. It says, when they came to the other side, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me what I can do for you before I am taken away." And Elisha replied, "Please let me inherit a double share of your spirit and become your successor." So here's the story. They're walking along. They go through the whole mess of everyone coming up and saying, hey, do you know what's happening? And Elijah saying to Elisha, hey, you stay here. No, I'm not going to stay here. They finally get to their destination. They get to their destination, and Elijah turns to Elisha, the teacher speaking to the student, and says to him, okay, you get one last request. What do you want? Okay, before I go, is there anything, you know, any last request that you would like for me to do for you? Anything that you would like me to teach you? Any question that you would like for me to answer? What would you like for me to do for you? And Elisha responds in a way that, to be honest with you, when I read it for the first time, when I honestly read it for the first time, it shocked me. Because, I understand that when you read it here, it doesn't sound like what it actually is, okay? Because you read it here, and it says, please let me inherit a double share of your spirit and become your successor. You know, we don't necessarily talk that way, so it doesn't really hit us. Let me put it in really plain English, what he's saying. The teacher says to the student, is there anything else, you know, any last things that you'd like for me to do for you? Yeah. I want to be twice the man you were. That's what he's saying. Okay, let me make it really, really simple for you. I want to be twice as powerful as you. Nothing big, right? Like, you're just the most powerful prophet in the history of Israel. I just want to be twice the man that you are. Now, I don't know about you, but first of all, I don't expect that request to be taken very well, okay? And then it just sounds absolutely, positively ridiculous. You want what? I don't know if you know this. Maybe you didn't pick this up in us, you know, journeying together and everything that I've taught you, but I'm kind of a big deal. Okay? And you want to be twice the man that I am? You would be lucky to be half the man that I am. Right? Can you imagine? Okay, most of you are in situations where you have performance reviews, right? As part of those performance reviews, you sit down with your boss, and usually in that conversation, there's conversation about goals, right? What do you want to do? What do you, you know, as you're part of this company over the next 5 years, what would you like to accomplish, right? We've all heard this. What would you like to see happen? Well, I just want to be twice the man you are. Can you imagine? Like, I just want over the next 5 years to, you know, have twice as many employees under me as you do right now. I'd like to make twice what you make. Maybe have twice the amount of vacation that you have. Just overall be twice as good as you. I mean, there's no way that's going to go over well. Can you imagine? I mean, it's absurd. The most powerful prophet in the history of the nation of Israel looks at his apprentice and says, what do you want? He says, I want to be twice what you were. And as I read that, I looked at that, I said, man, that's just arrogant. Why would you possibly think that you could be twice what he was? But as you read the story, and as the story continues, you see that God takes Elijah away in a whirlwind, and in the process, you see at the end of it that Elisha actually receives the spirit of Elijah. Let me just read it to you. Listen to how Elijah responds to him. You have asked a difficult thing. So he doesn't get really angry with him, but he acknowledges, okay, listen, you understand you're asking for a lot here. He says, if you see me when I'm taken from you, then you will get your request, but if not, then you won't. As they were walking along and talking, suddenly a chariot of fire appeared, drawn by horses of fire.
It drove between the two men, separating them, and Elijah was carried by a whirlwind into heaven. Elisha saw it and cried out, "My father, my father, I see the chariots and charioteers of Israel," and as they disappeared from sight, Elisha tore his clothes in distress. Elisha picked up Elijah's cloak, which had fallen when he was taken up. Then Elisha returned to the bank of the Jordan River. He struck the water with Elijah's cloak and cried out, "Where is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" Then the river divided, and Elisha went across. When the group of prophets from Jericho saw from a distance what happened, they exclaimed, "Elijah's spirit rests upon Elisha." And they went to meet him and bowed to the ground before him. And the cool thing is, too, and we don't know exactly whether this is true. There are a lot of people who argue for it. When you read through the stories, the biblical narrative of Elijah's life and Elisha's life, there's one thing that's really, really clear. Elisha was more powerful. Now, some people will argue, and I've heard both arguments. I don't think either one is convincing. Some people will argue that the Bible actually records twice as many miracles for Elisha as they do for Elijah. I don't know that that's accurate, but I can tell you one thing. There are a lot more. And the amazing thing is, as you look at it, you see that his requests, in some way, shape, or form, is answered. You think, man, I can't believe that. It seems like such an arrogant thing to ask. But then also, as you read through the rest of Elisha's story, you realize a couple of other things. Number one, Elisha knew what he was asking for. He knew that to do what his master had done meant that he was going to live the war as well. He knew the cost that was going to come with this request. And the other thing that you begin to learn about Elisha is that for Elisha, the request was never about him. It was always about the people. And at first, when you look at this moment, in the midst of this transition, at first, when you look at this moment, you think, wow, what an arrogant request. But when you step back and you see it in the context of his life, you realize this didn't have anything to do with him. But because he loved the people around him as much as he loved them, and when he got the chance to ask, he wasn't going to ask small. He was going to ask big. It's a beautiful parallel to what you see happen in Solomon's life when God comes to Solomon and says, "What do you want me to do for you?" And Solomon looks at the people and says, "How can I care for these people unless you give me wisdom? I want wisdom so I can care for them, so that I can love them." And in Elisha's life, you see the exact same thing. And Elisha's been traveling with Elijah and seeing these people and seeing what they need and seeing this battle that's going on for people's hearts between God and Baal. And so when he comes to this moment and he gets the chance to ask, he says, "I'm going big. And I think that these people need me to be twice what you are. And so I understand that God doesn't have to give it to me." As a matter of fact, he doesn't know. I love the way that he comes to the river and he strikes the river with the cloak. And it's almost this question. He actually asks the question, right? "Where is the God of Elijah? God, what are you going to do with my request? I understand. I'm not here to manipulate you. You can do whatever you want. But when I get the chance to ask, I'm not going small. I'm going big." And here's one of the things that you're going to discover as you're on this journey with God. And I think you see it in countless examples in Scripture, not just Elisha and Solomon. When you begin to fall in love with people the way that God loves people, you ask big. Because when you love people, it's not about what you feel comfortable with. It's not about what you think you can handle. It's not about you making it through. It's about loving them and serving them and seeing them experiencing Him as much as humanly possible. And so Elisha goes big. Five years ago, we started Hoboken Grace. And as we did, we sat down as a team and we said, okay, what are we going to ask God to do? What are we going to ask God to do in this city? What are we going to ask God to do through this church? And we wrote those things down on a sheet of paper, and I traveled the country, and I met with churches and individuals to raise money for what we were doing here. And I'd sit down with them, and I'd explain to them this weird little city called Hoboken. You probably never heard of it unless, you know, the Cake Boss wasn't popular then at that time. So very few people had heard of it. Now everybody knows it. I'm like, I'm a pastor in Hoboken. Oh, you know the Cake Boss. I'm like, no, I don't know the Cake Boss. It's become very well known now. But at that time, I explained to them this little city right beside Manhattan where all these churches were closing down and there were all these young people that were moving in. And I talked them through the city and the need and what we were looking to do. And then I set this sheet of paper down in front of them. It's part of our prospectus that we would give them. And I said, we're praying that in 5 years, we would have 500 people who come together to worship God every single weekend, to hear the message of who He is, and to take that out into the community in which they live. We're praying. This is what we're asking God for. And we understand that God can do whatever He wants to do. And if that doesn't happen, if God decides to do something else, that's fine. But when it comes down to what we're asking God for, this is what we're asking God to do. And I'll tell you the truth, some people looked at that and said, oh, that's kind of arrogant. Because for most of the churches in this area, they don't grow that fast. They don't see that happen. And then a lot of guys looked at it and said, you really think you can do that? And I said over and over again, I don't think I can do this. There's no way I can do this. There's no way our team can do this. But this is what we're asking God to do. Do you know how many people were here last week? 535. The week before, 507. I don't know why God chose to answer that request almost exactly. But I know this. In the process, He taught me what you see in this passage. When you fall in love with people, you don't ask small. You ask big. And God can do what He wants to do. But we're going to ask big. And as we walk through this transition, as we move out of the first 5 years and we begin to look at what the next 5 years are going to have in store for us, I want this to drive our conversation. I want this to drive everything that we're doing. And this isn't just about how we're expanding into these other locations. This is about us as individuals. I want us to begin to embody this. I want this to soak into the very fiber of who we are. So that as an apprentice, when you come to the point where you're going to step into leadership of a dinner group, it's not just, I hope I don't destroy this group, I hope I make it through the night, I hope I don't say anything stupid, but that you step into it and you say, God, I want to be twice the leader that the previous leader was. And I know our first inclination is, man, that's so arrogant. And some of you are leaders, you're like, wow, I don't want them to ask that. But the problem is, it's because we don't love people. And we don't understand that this is all about loving people.
I remember the first time that I walked through this passage, it actually hit me because I was in school at the time and working through my theology degree and there were all sorts of questions. Everyone was always asking me, are you going to be a pastor? Are you going to be a pastor? I was always like, no, don't be ridiculous. That's absurd. I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm just doing this first and then I'm going to go to law school. There's no way God wants me to be a pastor. But there's always these questions in my mind and I always said to myself, if I'm going to be a pastor, I just like to be a pastor, you know, of a church, just a little church of 200 people and just have that church just be a solid church that really cared for each other. And as I had this conversation with myself and with those around me, God brought me to this passage and said, Chris, the reason you're asking for that is because you think it's about humility. You think you're being humble. You think that you're actually doing something good by asking for less. He says, but the reason you're asking for that is because you're focused on you and not them. Because if you loved them, you would want the biggest church you could possibly have. You would want to do everything that you can to reach as many of them as you possibly can. Chris, don't fool yourself with this stupid humility stuff. For some of us, we come to God and we say, God, I just want to take care of my family, or I'm not going to ask for a lot. I'm just going to ask for this. And we think it's humility. It's not. It's that we haven't fallen in love yet. And as we move through this transition, I want this to drive us. I want for each and every one of us, not just for us as a family, but for each and every one of us, I want this to become part of who we are. And so it doesn't matter what we do. It doesn't matter if you're a submarine diver. So you didn't get that? Seriously? Every submarine movie has that sound, right? Like, doot, 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 right? Every single submarine, it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter what you do. Whether you're a ministry leader, whether you're a dinner group leader, whether you're a greeter, whatever it may be, when you step into that, it's not just, I hope I don't screw this up. I hope I don't do anything wrong. I hope I do a decent job. I hope we make it through Sunday morning. I hope we get the chairs set up on time. No, that's not what we're asking for. I want to do it twice as good as I did last week. I want to be twice the leader this year that I was last year. Why? Because of me? Because of my name? No. Because when we look around the city, people need to know who God is. And so we're going to ask big. And I want to tell you, as we transition from this first 5-year period to the next 5-year stretch as a family, we're not asking God to do what He's done before. We're not asking God that in a year from now we'd see 500 more people be part of our family. We're not asking God that in 5 years we would have 3 locations firmly established. As we go into the next 5 years, we're asking God that in 5 years from now this church would be 5,000 people who are moving inside of the cities along this waterfront to be able to demonstrate and communicate who God is in ways that people are coming to know Christ over and over and over again. We're not asking for 3 locations. We want 10 locations over the next 5 years, all the way from Edgewater to Paulus Hook, that the vision is beginning to be realized that there is a location within walking distance of every single person along this waterfront. Why? Because we want Hoboken Grace or Hamilton Grace or any of these other graces that are going to come up to be popular or big. No, it's not about that. If we're going to love our city, our cities, our coworkers, our families, our neighbors, then it demands that we ask big.
And here's one thing I never want to be true of us. Jesus is walking with his disciples, and one day he says to them, "You have not because you ask not." That will not be true here. That will not be true here. And we understand that God's plan and God's will is bigger than ours. And we're not here to manipulate God. God, you can do what you want to do with us. And we're going to pay attention to what we know to do and be faithful with that. But God, this is our city. These are our people. These are our coworkers and neighbors and families. And so, God, we're going to ask for every single one. Everyone. Will you pray with me? Father, as we walk through this and we look at this unbelievable request and how it teaches us to love those around us, Dad, we want to be used to love more. And as we look at the next 5 years, we ask you, and it's going to have to be you because we don't know how to get there or what it would look like or how this is going to happen. God, we ask you that there would be 10 locations where month after month, along this waterfront, men and women were standing up and saying, "I've been made new." We pray that there would be over 5,000 people who would be united with one mission of helping people find their way back to you. That your glory, your love, your grace, your name would begin to flood into our cities. Because of how those 5,000 live and operate and communicate. Father, we don't deserve for you to have answered the first request. But you've taught us that this is what it means to love. And unbelievably, when we asked big, you said yes. And so, Dad, again, we come before you. And we ask big for you and for those who do not yet know the way you love them. In Jesus' name, amen.